the information. If we've got any time left, we'll maybe open it up a little bit. But I really enjoyed, I was talking to Lisa at the break and enjoyed talking about some of the things that, there's some real practical down-to-earth application for a lot of this stuff because of what's going on in our, you can't hardly throw a stone and not hit an, it seems like an either an atheist or somebody wanting to bring up the issue of the gay right for marriage vote thing that's going on, and all that kind of business. And so, it's amazing, what when you kind of take the Christian world and you look at it as far as you start losing enormous chunks of it when you start getting pushback. Usually you'll lose huge chunks of it because people just won't push back or won't take a stand. And by taking a stand right now with some things, just making going down and voting for an issue like that, but others, you lose large chunks of them because normally an atheist can out-argue a Christian. Most of them can. And like I said, I think it's I have a warped sense of humor, but I think that the most hilarious thing I've seen in the last decade is an atheist with a shirt on that says reason and logic. I just think that's the most hilarious thing I've ever seen. Because there is no reason or logic in atheism. None. So that's that. Well, let's turn our attention back to Romans chapter 3. And we're now looking at this last and final stage here of the unbeliever who is opposing himself. Once again, verse 7 comes along and says, "For if the truth of God hath more abounded through my lie unto his glory, why yet am I also judged as a sinner?" Now, we come to look at Paul actually grabs a hold of a thread here. You've got, I don't know if this will work or not. No, it's not going to. We'll go back to it. You've got this, if the truth of God, that issue that comes up there, I'm going to take that off because I'm writing red on top of red. But that little phrase, the truth of God, is very interesting because Paul actually grabs a hold of something, the thread of something that's already been laid. And he talks about the truth of God. And the truth of God here, when he says, "For if the truth of God," this refers back to all of those things that Paul has been dealing with up to this point in connection with the fact that God is perfectly righteous. God is perfectly holy. And we by nature are ungodly, which is what Paul starts off with all the way back. And actually, if you flip back, just look at verse 18 of chapter 1 when he begins this presentation. "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth." That truth there is the truth about God, the truth of God, and in unrighteousness. And again, that's what we were talking about an atheist. An atheist, I absolutely have no problem whatsoever by saying they absolutely know that there is a God. The thing of it is that they have shoved this out of their life and out of their existence so far that they've actually worked it around to where they no longer believe that there's a God. That's a huge issue. They no longer believe that. And so I do know that what I'm going to stick with what God says, and he makes himself known. And so therefore, the truth of God refers again to something that Paul starts off the gospel with there in verse 18. But now this Jew, in this particular case, this unbeliever, is backed into a corner. And Paul's using obviously that issue because he's talking about the circumcision here and this kind of thing. He's talking about the self-opposing Jew, but though it's not exclusively to him, because this almost serves as a model for what you'll find in every unbeliever who opposes himself. And he's now in that position where he's digging in his heels, he's into a corner, he's in an unpleasant situation. And he's just been shown from the information that you've gone over so far in the book of Romans, there is no difference. He is absolutely no different from any old run-of-the-mill, cursed and ungodly Gentile. And so therefore, he's coming along and realizing that he's been put in this position. and he is as unrighteous and ungodly as that Gentile was, and he has no way of escape and no way out. And so he's going to attempt to make a case for himself. That's what he's going to do. Scramble around with what he's got left of his brain and try to come up with a way in which he's going to declare, in essence, by what he says, that, okay, what I've really done by my existence. It's almost like, yeah, he kind of looks at you and says, well, you may think my being what I am is gross and inconceivable to you and to God as being anything like God. The truth of the matter is, and that's what he's going to fill in the blanks on, the truth of the matter is, I really helped him out by being what I am. And so he's going to come along and say, for him to judge me would be awful, because I've been the one who was able to take his truth. The truth of God hath more abounded through my lie. I've been able to abound his truth because of my sinful condition, because of my ungodliness. I put his truth on display by comparison, by contrast. You say, well, that's crazy. Logic and reason doesn't enter into it. Like I said, you have to be highly educated to get to this point, but you've got to throw logic and reason out. What you've actually got going on here is absolute, pure, unadulterated politics. This is the greatest spin control you've ever seen. This is exactly what you could watch it on with any president, senators, congressmen, name them. Yeah, right, left, indifferent, I don't care who they are. This is pure spin control. It's nothing but political spin control. It's the and it's an effort, just like spin control is an effort to make, especially by politicians, a favorable interpretation of something horrible. A favorable interpretation of their words and actions. You have some horrible, This is Edwards. This is Bill Clinton. This is Obama. And this is a lot of this is Nixon. This is a politician. So he comes along and says, for if the truth of God hath abounded more through my lie. And he's going to come along and he's going to talk about the truth about God and the truth of God, and it's abounded, it's excelled through my lie, through my falsehood, unto his doxa, unto his glory, his essence, his character, the full recognition of God's righteousness and his essence and his character, his godness. Well, then why yet am I also judged as a sinner? And the idea behind being judged here is that's what he's after getting away from, the judgment. The idea behind being judged, krino, is that of being brought and placed under indictment as a sinner. You're just like any old Gentile. This is another one of those goofball things that you're going to get from an unbeliever who would like to say, well, I don't want anything to do with your Christianity because it's intolerant. Well, I want to tell you something. If you took a loaded 45 and put it to the temple of that unbeliever, I think they'd become highly intolerant of you. And they should. The idea is that intolerance is a bad thing, and all it's bad across the board. But you have to be able to turn the tables on them and say, no, Christianity is tolerant of everybody. You're all sinners. And tell me what is intolerant about whosoever will. I don't care who you are. I don't care what you are. I don't care what you call yourself. I don't care if you're a homosexual, you're a transvestite. I don't care if you're into bestiality. I don't care who you are or what you are, or if you're just a rural farm boy from Nowhereville, Indiana. You're all just as lost, just as sinful, just as unjustified, just as worthy of the wrath of God. I don't see where that's at all intolerant. It includes everybody. It's all inclusive. The whole human race of Adam. The whole human race. And the whole human race can be saved by believing in Jesus Christ's death and burial and resurrection for them. That he died for their sins, was buried and arose to give them a new life. And they can be justified just like anybody else. Where is this intolerance in Christianity? I don't see where it is in being a Christian. The problem is they want to turn the tables on you. Paul doesn't let them do that. So really, this last doting question is raised, and the objection in the fourth stage of self-opposition gets asked. But it's very interesting. Instead of the self-opposer deflecting Paul's argument, Paul deflects this absurd question. Because this is not really what you're driving at, is it? This is one of those areas where you have to look behind the curtain. That's not really what you're driving at. This is all spin control. This isn't really the issue you want to get to. This isn't what you really want to say, is it? There's a real issue that's behind all this. And that's what he gets to. For if the truth of God hath more abounded through my lie unto his glory, why yet am I also judged as a sinner? Well, this last objection of self-opposition of the unbeliever, it is the final question in the series that you've got here that Paul deals with. And as we're being trained and educated as ambassadors for Christ, it's the nature of the kind of questions that we're to expect when blasphemy accompanies it. And we're to do just exactly when that happens what Paul does here. When blasphemy occurs, not when certain other things are said, but when you get to that particular point, when the blasphemy occurs, you've got to do what Paul does here. Paul doesn't deal with it. He does not deal with it. He does not even refute it. And we understand that God himself doesn't want us to deal with this self-opposer any longer. So this final objection, an attempt to get his case excused, to get his case thrown out of the court of God's justice, argues that since my sin has actually helped God out, and you got to think for a moment about what, it's almost like you hear that verse 7 and you say, what are you saying? In that last phrase, after the semicolon, why yet am I also judged as a sinner? What are you implying? I don't answer that. Think about it. What are you implying? Because that's what's behind all this. If my unrighteousness makes the truth of God more abound, what would God be if he judged me as a sinner then? Unfair? Yeah. Goes deeper than that.
I'm in a higher position than Paul, because I'm questioning his being.
Well, yeah. And that's good. That's good. It goes beyond that. There's a step beyond that. Evil. You're saying to God, you'd be evil to judge me as a sinner. And do you know what you've just done in thinking that? And what the horror of this is? Who is evil? What have you just put God in the position of being? Satan himself. you've made God into the adversary. That's the horror of blasphemy. That's the horror of the self-opposer's mind that has gone to that extent, and why the blasphemy doesn't even get a reply. You cut them off. It's really fascinating how it's brought out. That really is a desperate argument. Most people overlook that little three-letter word, yet. Why yet am I also judged as a sinner? Yet? Yet is an expression of time and degree. It's one of those great words of logic in our language that's used here in a most illogical way. It's used to draw attention to a simple contrast, to something adverse that's happening. Why yet? This yet speaks volumes about how this self-opposer thinks about himself and how he thinks about God. For he still is unable to see himself as God sees him. My lie. If the truth of God hath abounded through my lie. He views, just like that issue, my lie, goes right back up here into the second stage area, because he's already viewed himself as he sees his lying as an asset. There's no liability in lying. But that little yet, that little word yet, may also indicate something even deeper. It indicates an almost fanatical obsession with oneself. Why yet am I? Just like you brought out. They want to put themselves in a position higher than God. I've dealt with some atheists before. I've never, ever had an atheist bother me in one bit by anything they said, because I know exactly what's going to happen to them. And so it really doesn't bother me. The only thing that bothers me, again, is the fact that they're not saved. That's what bothers me. There's nothing an atheist could ever say that could shake anything. I mean, I know they couldn't shake you out of anything. But that kind of thinking has all these layers of being veiled in sensibility and being veiled in reason, being veiled in logic. And yet, it's just like with the issue of evolution. I've stood at the base of it, and I've looked up and I've seen Mount Rushmore. Four presidents, Mount Rushmore. I don't think there's any evolutionist, atheist, or even geologist who would ever look at those figures and turn to each other and say, I wonder how many billions of years it took for them to erode to be that. How long did it take for them to just naturally form into that? Let's write books, start schools, and give doctorate degrees to try to figure it out. They don't even go down that road. They know, what was his name, Borglum? You can actually see the holes on it where they blasted all the blasting rock down at the bottom of it. They'll look at a piece of rock that, by comparison, is night and day to the actual men, to the real George Washington, the real Thomas Jefferson, the real Teddy Roosevelt, the real Abraham Lincoln, the real human bodies that they had. And they'll look at their real human bodies with all the machinery and all the design that's in them and say, that evolved. It's by comparison billion times more intricate in its design than Mount Rushmore. So you're telling me that's logic? and that's reason. Okay, I'm not buying what you're selling. But again, this is kind of following that snapping that takes place that I was talking about in our previous class. That little yet digs deeper, where that self-opposer is almost fanatically obsessed with himself and views himself as incapable of wrongdoing. Because my wrongdoing actually turned out right. I've known people who do that. They justify everything they do to where their wrongdoing actually turns out right. And they've set a view of God, of themselves, as ones who view themselves as God's match in the area of judgment and in the area of administration. Just like you were bringing out, Helen. That indicates the extent of their pride and their arrogance. And while granted it needs further development, there may be enough evidence in related scripture to indicate that it may be possible that the final words to come out of the mouth of the adversary, of Satan himself. Don't pin me down on this. But if I were to think about what the final words that had come out of the adversary's mouth just before he was cast in the lake of fire, it's something just like that. You can't do that to me! I helped you! If it wasn't for me, you wouldn't be seen to be the holy God you are. Why yet am I judged as a sinner when my lie has worked to make your glory abound? Remember that adversary's pride has been deeply wounded, and that's not a small matter to him. And that's exactly what will happen with any self-opposed unbeliever. With a wounded pride that seeks to save face in any desperate way that it can, man or angel. And this is regarded by God to be the highest degree of blasphemy a creature can utter. And that is, you, God, need me. Very simple words. You needed me. By the way, Paul addresses that issue. Come back to, we're going to close here a little early for my birthday. Come back to Acts 17, that magnificent defense of Paul at Mars Hill. I could read this thing 100 times and never get tired of it. I just love watching the step by step by step as Paul presents the gospel of Christ to these men. But notice, in contrast to that high sense of pride and arrogance and ultimate blasphemy, no, God, I don't need you. You need me. And without me, you're not who you are. Look at that in contrast to what Paul, again, he addresses that issue, but on the very opposite end of the spectrum. Come down and pick it up there. Well, let's start right at verse 22. Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill, and he said, "You men of Athens, I perceive that in all things ye are too superstitious. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. Whom therefore ye ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you." You notice how Paul found something in common with their culture? And it was an open door for him to walk right through and say, "All right, you don't know this God. I'm going to present him to you. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of..." I love this. This is the verse. This is one of the verses I'm after, 24 and 25. Paul's able to get into this, whether they're aware of it or not, but just it's just so beautiful, because it's got to just twist the adversary in knots to hear this. But notice in verse 24, God that made the world and all things therein. So evolutionists are blown out of the water right there. Seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth. that is so great. That's the contention of all time. That he is Lord of heaven and earth. Jehovah, the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. He gets the conflict of the ages is mentioned right there in those little words. He dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, here's what I'm after, verse 25, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things. See what the self-opposer has done? He's put God into the position of being evil, of being the adversary, of taking an adversarial role, and him in a position of needing you. And Paul comes along and rightly says, just there, as he does there in verse 20, as though he needed anything. He is not worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything. It's just the diametric opposite of that's how far the unbeliever in self-opposition blasphemy goes. That's how far his mind has gone. And so these words that you see here in verse 7 may not be at all the exact words, but the thinking that has framed the words, the thoughts that have framed the words are going to be the same in the self-opposer. So words like these may be the words of many unbelievers as they are judged in the final judgment. I fully expect to hear the atheist come up with this particular kind of argument at the great white throne judgment. I fully expect to hear so many unbelievers go to this point and try as in their last ditch effort, if saying anything could even be allowed, that the argument would run something very similar to this. In any case, these and words very similar are the words of some of the most great, what our country and our world today holds up as some of the most prominent so-called great thinkers. They think along these lines. That until you can eradicate God from your mind, you can't really be free in your mind. To throw off the chains of religion, to throw off the chains of the Bible, to throw off the chains of God. They call them chains. They call them all kinds of derogatory things. I know two lawyers, one of my dad's age and one of my age. Alan Dershowitz of my age thinks along these lines. But this is so old. That's another thing that I get a kick out of when I hear an atheist or an evolutionist. That they think that they can come up with something new, a new jab. I can get a new dig in on you that I bet you've never heard before. If they only knew how ancient their thinking is. The only cutting-edge thinking in the world is in this book. This book can outthink science. It's far advanced than science. It talks about things that science looks at and says, you got to be crazy. I'm not going to tell you where, but you're going to stumble across passages in the Word of God in which you're going to see God say things about clouds. And you thought, I thought Greg Fischel knew all there was to know about a cloud. They don't know anything about them, according to what God knows that they can do. They don't know what a firmament is, I can tell you that, and they don't know what it can do. But this is the kind of thinking that, in my dad's age, a great thinker like Clarence Darrow had. My dad used to tell me about, he was just a youngster at the time, he was 10, but he could very well remember the great Scopes monkey trial down in Dayton, Tennessee. Clarence Darrow was the defense attorney for John Scopes. And as a fascinating. I have that entire transcript of that whole trial. It had nothing to do with evolution. It had everything to do with the King James Bible. That was the trial of the King James Bible. So if the truth of God hath abounded, for if the truth of God hath more abounded through my lie unto his glory, why yet am I also judged as a sinner? And when you get the truth of that and peel back what even lies behind it, you do see the blasphemy that's in that statement. Well, we're going to stop there for tonight, and on Sunday we're going to pick it up at verse 8. And all we're going to do is once again just briefly run through verse 8 and probably put a little summary to it. Then we'll come back to our passage in Romans. I think this is it. Nope. In Romans 12, verses 13, 14, and 15. And then we're going to look at verse 15, the indifferent response. That won't take very much time at all. And that'll be it for the fifth component. We'll do a little post-doctrinal exhortation. We can have questions and answers. I might do some of that even on Sunday, because I know some of you have got some good things to say about what we're talking about, because you've dealt with people that fit these kind of scenarios. But anyway, I think we'll stop it there for tonight. And after verse 15, we just got one more verse, and we'll have the very first of four components under our belt. So that's a milestone. All right, we'll stop right there and pick it up then on Sunday morning with our heads bowed.